In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Wow, here we are, episode number 2. We made it, we didn't go bankrupt, and we didn't get bought out. And that's despite all of the hostile podcast takeovers that we were subject to. So I think that deserves a round of applause, guys.
Yay!
Now then, last week we were, I don't know, were we 5 or 6? This
six.
Week we're only 3. 6 last week, right?
Yeah.
So just 3 this week. So there's no Rick and no Mark Farley. Those guys are traveling. And Zilla last week, what a stand-up guy, right?
Yeah.
Well done to him. And also, I think, well done to EMC for rolling with what we threw at them. Because I know Zilla was on the show as a guest, kind of hoping he'll be a regular guest. And then we dropped that bomb on him. And I think some of us laid the boot in, probably especially me. So well done to the guy last week. He's not with us this week. I thought I'd better not hassle him to see if he wants to come on again. So who have we got this week? We've got Hans. What's going on with you?
Hey, I got a little bit of a cough, so I don't know how much I'm going to have to mute myself in between. And I hope I don't cough when I'm unmuted.
So. Hey, Hans, how do we contact you on Twitter and where do you blog?
I'm just everywhere. Hans Dahlin here. That's the account I use everywhere. If you cannot spell that, which I understand, just look for the IT Hulk.
The IT Hulk. Okay, cool. Gabriel Chapman.
Yes, sir.
How are you? What are you up to at the moment?
I am actually coming to you live from the Southern California VMware End User Conference with about 450 of my personal closest friends.
That's a lot of friends, that is.
It is. It's a good show. I mean, the VMUG EUC events are great. It's a chance for, it's almost like a mini VM world. You'll get a lot of people show up. You get a lot of vendors. There's swag. So for those of you in the VMware community who can't get to an actual VM world, it's kind of the next best thing.
And what are you doing there right now? I mean, are you speaking? Are you doing any demos or anything?
No, actually, I'm here kind of on my own. Rick Scher from EMC asked me to be on a panel with Nick Howe from NetApp, Doug Baer from VMware, Alistair Cook, who's running the V Brown Bag group here, and myself, to just kind of go up there and have general purpose discussion with VMUG attendees, see what the questions they have. It's kind of an ask the experts, but we had a nice session and discussion around conversion infrastructure, hyper-convergence, which I have a background in. As well as some of the other things that are happening in, you know, around Evo Rail and some of the other technologies that are out there, and what's a good fit and what's not.
You got any thoughts on Evo Rail at the moment?
You know, I think it's an interesting play. It's, you know, it's VMware not being a hardware company. It's VMware selling a reference architecture software stack to specific hardware vendors that want to go to market with a reference architecture that they can leverage. And it allows customers to take advantage of some of the better VMware products packaged as one SKU. You know, it'll be interesting to see how that grows and which of the companies that are vendors today take advantage and really run with it versus one of the others that just kind of use it as another, you know, quiver in their arsenal.
I was at VMworld San Francisco when they unveiled Evo Rail. I was so happy it was not a VMware appliance. I cannot say this enough. We didn't know what project, Mystic Project, and what was the other name?
Marvin.
Yeah, and there were some hints that it would have been a true VMware appliance, and I'm so happy that VMware has not decided to go into hardware selling, because they're just not – it's a software company not built to sell, maintain, support anything that is hardware related. I'm very happy it did not go that way.
So just conscious of any potential listeners we've got that aren't really savvy with what this is, do either of you think you can give a good one or two sentence overview?
Yeah, it's basically it's about how you buy your infrastructure. So instead of buying servers and storage, all different components, they decided to bring everything back into OneNode. Now, today you can do that already with VMware, just putting vSAN into your nodes and manually configuring it that way. Evil Rail takes it just one step beyond that server plus vSAN and makes it pre-configured as is. So there's no extra checkbox and options here and there. No, this is the configuration. The configuration is going to be identical over all the OEMs. And that's just the box you buy, model A, model B, model C, and you're gonna build it. So it's all about the flexibility of building it yourself. That's how you do it with the components or building a vSAN ready nodes versus the easy way of buying, just buy another model and don't care about the actual configuration.
Uh-huh. And I think I agree as well that it was a good move not to get into the hardware side of things as well, or the appliance side. It seems across the board that, you know, the hardware companies are all scrambling to get into the software business and to get into the services business at the moment. So hardware's almost really, really not old-fashioned, but it's kind of out of fashion at the moment. And for a company like VMware to have said, you know, we're going to pile in and start shipping appliances and stuff, I'd probably have been a bit like you, Hans, and thought, don't think that's a great way forward.
I'm not saying that hardware is boring, and I really love that there's companies building good hardware products. For me, the biggest reason was that VMware is in itself a 100% software company. And build to deliver software, to develop software, and delivering and the distribution channel, the support channel, the sales channel is completely different when you speak about hardware appliances. It's a completely different company need for doing that. That's why it's good that they're working with the OEMs now, because they have that channel. They have the sales, the maintenance, and the production channel of a hardware appliance. I mean, they could have OEM some hardware, but it's not only about the building that appliance, it's also about how do you sell it. And VMware has never sold hardware. They've only been selling software, and the same thing goes for support staff and so on. So it was certainly going to be something, again, together with EMC, because they do it, which is going to offend some of the partners. I mean, this is the best deal that could happen. I really support Evil Rail as a concept and how it is brought to market today. The only thing that would, I mean, I would bring them on the table to look at. The only thing that I'm still thinking about is that it is a Gen 1 storage layer underneath. It's still Gen 1, and there's other players in that market today that have a far more mature product.
And Gabriel, I know you're wanting to come in there on something.
No, no worries.
But just on that very last point you've made there, Hans, I think I read in Chad Sakach's blog post the other week about the disruptive Extreme IO upgrade. He was also suggesting in there, at least I think this is where it was, that vSAN is very much a 1.0 product. And when it goes to 2.0, we could potentially be expecting similarly or a similar disruptive approach to the upgrade from vSAN 1 to vSAN 2. And not that a disruptive upgrade is always the end of the world, but it suggests there are still major enhancements and major changes to be made to the vSAN code base.
I'm not going to comment on that. I have nothing on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, with VMware, there's a, you know, I mean, if you look at the progression of VMFS and how it's changed over the years, the migration path was always, you know, deploy new and then vMotion or storage vMotion over. And I think that they have the benefit of having that level of abstraction. It may not be as disruptive as, you know, say, an actual physical appliance. Getting back to why VMware doesn't get into the hardware business is, one, it's very low margin. And two, they just don't have the sales staff, the infrastructure staff, the support staff to really wrestle with that. And you get a much larger market penetration with having 6 or 7 OEMs pushing your product, which essentially is the software where all the margins are at, than you would if you were trying to press it all yourself.
Yeah, and they've done a great job always in the past, even when they've, you know, had all the things like the VAAI integration and stuff like that, to be really wide open. I know they could only select like a handful of partners to work on it, and it would come with some storage vendors before it came out with others, or it would be supported by some storage vendors before others. But they've always done it, in my opinion, a pretty cracking job. of not saying, guess what, you know, we're majority owned by EMC, so we're going to nail ourselves to EMC and they're going to get everything first. And they've not done that. And I think that's been to their benefit. Like you say, everybody is then scrambling to push their product and to be, you know, seen to be in bed with VMware and all that. And it's worked really well for them in the past.
Yeah, definitely agree on that. Definitely.
For sure.
Now, maybe a bit of a segue on a kind of similar topic, because one of the things I was thinking when you were saying VMware is a 100% software company, sure, but it is majority owned by EMC, who I know sell themselves as a software company these days, but have a huge old hardware portfolio. So that maybe leads us on to, there have been some reports in the news recently that EMC talked to HP, talked to a bunch of other companies about mega mergers and things like that. We got any thoughts on those?
Yeah, so to give it a little bit of background, there's two things happening. The first thing is that Joe Tucci would be going maybe finally on a retirement next year. So that's the first question. What's going to happen with the overall what's the name again of the EMC group? So that's the first question. What's going to happen when Joe Tucci retires? But the second thing is that there's an activist investors group called Elliott Management Holding, and they bought in, I think, about 1 billion stock in EMC, which is, I think,
2.2% of the shares.
Yeah, 2-3%. Yeah. So not nothing. I mean, it's not nothing. But they only bought the stock to make something happen, and of course make something out of their money. And now they're pushing EMC to sell off parts of the company. So that was the first rumor of last week, was that are they going to sell VMware? That was the first question. And then after that, this week came out that they're would have been actually pretty far-going conversations for a merger between EMC and HP. It were still rumors. There's a lot of people that took it for quite serious. But I think that would be one of the worst ideas ever.
Go on. What are your thoughts on why would it be that bad?
First of all, I think there's a huge overlap. Not on all sides, but there is a huge overlap between the two companies, as in portfolio.
A lot more so than if they were to merge or be bought by somebody like Cisco, right?
Well, let's keep it for 1 minute with the HP and EMC merge, right? And maybe we can expand on that. But I mean, there's a huge overlap here in products between HP and EMC, and I think they go after the same customers, which is the second thing. And I think together they wouldn't have 80% of their revenue of what they're having today.
I would agree there as well. I don't think that HP and EMC are a good fit. Just to go back to some of the impetus for this, this is a common practice that they do. They've done this with Brocade, they did it with Emulex, they did it with QLogic, they did it with a few others. They go after companies they think that are undervalued and then try to force some kind of change or shake up in either the management tier by either A, getting a CEO or somebody out, or A, divesting particular product lines that they feel should be wealth given back to the shareholders. In this case, it would be spinning off VMware. I could think of two companies that were less well-suited to merger when it comes to, everybody talks about the technology, but nobody's talking about the sales staff, right? You look at how HP addresses a sale and how EMC addresses a sale, that's like putting two beta fish in a room or in a pool themselves and letting them become friends. I don't think that fits. Yeah. And I also think that you look at, you know, what HP's core competencies are, and, you know, storage is part of it, but it's not the whole picture. I mean, you see them starting to move into OpenStack and open source to a certain extent. You see large layoffs coming semi-periodically. HP is a large organization, and while I believe that, you know, Meg Whitman has come in and been a good stabilizing force, I still think that that's an organization that could start to really focus on some key areas and make those their core competencies instead of trying to be all things to everyone.
Yeah, right? I agree. I mean, since Meg Whitman came on, we really have seen what was necessary, a stabilization of the company. And I'm not sure they're ready to shake it all up again, especially not in such a huge merger. Maybe HP is ready to get back into the acquisition thing, which has been a while. I'm not sure if they need anything new. They probably want something new. I don't know. But it was stable. They've bought so much in such a short time, 3 to 4 years ago, that the salespeople didn't know what to do with it. The company didn't know where to go. She brought some stability. There hasn't been that much of acquisition stuff being done in the last 2 to 3 years, which gave them that time to really go with what they want to focus on. I think a merger or new acquisitions could swipe that all that stability away again.
It would completely upset the apple cart. And like, I think, you know, still smarting from autonomy and, that's a mark that's going to leave a mark for a long time. And I think that the merger of those two types of those two companies, you know, I just don't see what HP really gains from it, where they could actually, I would like to much more see HP maybe, you know, divest some of these other some of these items, maybe print. I mean, even though, gosh, I wish I owned the patent for printer ink. I'd be buying Larry Ellison's Island. Yeah. But, I would like to see them get back to their roots. I want to see them invest heavily in R&D and take the properties and intellectual property that they have and use that to their benefit and to their customers. You know, that's what I would like to see, a move back towards, you know, getting back to the R&D area that they were prior to certain people coming on board and shuttling, you know, all of that effort.
That would be Mark Hurd.
To an extent, yeah. But, you know, we don't have to name names.
Do large companies like HP, EMC, IBM, do those guys innovate in R&D these days anymore? I mean, I know that, like, IBM seems to, well, has had a history of doing loads of R&D, and then...
Well, IBM has, I mean, Watson is a pretty big deal.
I know, but how does it affect their bottom line at the end of the day? What do they productize out of it that really affects their bottom line? I see so much of this R&D seems to just be picked up by somebody else in the long run, and they go and productize it and they go and make money and somebody goes and buys them. I don't know that the likes of IBM and HP are really great places to be throwing loads of R&D money, because it's almost, I could be wrong here, but it seems like you're throwing your money away sometimes.
I tend to liken it to the moon mission, right? You know, there was so much created out of the race to the moon from an intellectual property and an art and technology standpoint, that the far-reaching aspects and the productization of did not come for 5, 10, even 20 years later. And when you look at some of these organizations, I think that they are looking 10 and 20 years out to what some of this investment is. I mean, Cisco, for, you know, at their point, the Internet of Everything, Internet of Things, there's not an immediate tangible return on that, but that's a much more longer-reaching strategy than something, you know, widget X that's going to get you some quick market share in the short term.
Yeah, I think Cisco is one of those places where that is happening today, that R&D that is not tied to actual products that go to market today.
Fair enough. I don't know. I just think that, you know, it doesn't matter how much money these guys plow into R&D. At a big company like that, if you don't spin off... another company that goes in and develops the product for you, and then you buy them back in, it doesn't seem to work. They always seem to end up just buying up the startups where the real innovation seems to happen.
Well, Pivotal is a good example, where they spun off some of the R&D departments of VMware and EMC to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a longer-term play too, though.
That's definitely a
longer-term solution. There's some
and a really,
really
strategic one.
Exactly.
And what are we talking about when we say long-term?
I tend to look long-term as anything past, you know, if we look at it from an investment standpoint, anything past 3 years. But, you know, 5 years is starting to look mid to long-term in my viewpoint. Mm-hmm. 12 to 24 months is short-term. 3 years could be mid-term. But, you know, I mean, you're looking at some of this stuff. I think that what Pivotal is doing is they're kind of focusing on that next wave of analytics. It's a lot, you know, it's a lot of talk about big data. It's kind of like where cloud was 5 years ago, right?
Yeah.
You know, everybody was talking about it, but nobody was really doing it. There's going to come a point where this big data aspect or some of these analytics aspects really start to become part of everyday, you know, from the SMB to mid-tier to the enterprise, injected and ingrained into their daily decision-making patterns.
Yeah.
If you look at the life of a new startup, it's almost always it's someone that comes out of an existing R&D department in one of the big companies and says, I can't build this on my own in this company. I'm starting from scratch. It takes them, most of the time, it takes them 2 to 3 years to get a Gen 1 product out. I'm not speaking about beta products and so on, but it takes them at least 2 to 3 years to get there. And I think it's the same thing for Pivotal and so on. It's going to take them 3 years to get something decent into the market. And they're already halfway. I mean, we should expect something to come out there in the next years.
I mean, there's interesting stuff going on there with Pivotal, but just bringing it back momentarily to HP, if you go and say, we're going to invest a load of money, and HP have got, well, they've been in a better financial position in their history, let's just put it that way. They then go to Wall Street or to shareholders and say, you know what, we're investing all of this money in stuff that's like 5 years out there. It's quite a hard sell, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, then. So let's just switch gears here a minute. I picked something up in the news, I think, just earlier on today about Google building a new data center, €600 million, $800 million data center out in the Netherlands. Has anybody ever been to a Google data center before, either of you guys?
No, but I have. The biggest one in Europe is in Belgium, and I haven't even been there. It's less than 100 miles out of my house, so I should go there one day. I don't know how easy it is to get in there, but it's not that far, so I should get in there.
You should just rock up at the front door, right? You're like Belgian technology royalty.
IT Hulk smash.
Yeah.
I've seen one on Google Maps.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've seen like the pictures and stuff that they do of them. I've never really been to any really cool data centers. You know, I've been to, you know, standard stock data centers, right? And they're pretty cool and all that. But I've never been, let's say, to SuperNap or anywhere like that.
Oh, you have to.
You have to go to SuperNap.
Yeah. Mean, if you ever
contact Missy, she'll get you in any time.
Yes.
Cool. I'll have to do that. But this
is data center porn.
Absolutely. 101.
It is. I've been to pretty much all the data. I mean, and there's funny because like Las Vegas area is like a data center magnet in that whole area. They use it as the maps that I've seen from Cobalt to ViaWest to SuperNap and the others is basically there are no natural disasters that can destroy this place. Mm-hmm. The only one I think of is maybe Godzilla because of all the nuclear radiation buried in the ground. Yeah. But, you know, it is a great place, and it just seems to be the magnet for these super data center structures. And if you look at the footprint that SuperNap has created over the last 7 years, it is just each one of the additional spin ups that they do is just bigger and better and more crazier than the other. It's it really is data center nerd nirvana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before they start building the next one, it's already sold out.
Yeah. I mean, data centers big business these days, right? I know when I was writing the data center related chapter of my storage book back end of last year, I did a bit of research into it, and they were saying that, you know, the power footprint of a large data center and something like SuperNap will totally blow this out of the water, right? But they were saying that the kind of power that you require for a fairly decent sized data center is as much as a moderately large city, a city that's got like, I don't know, just over 250,000 people living in it. And that is a lot of power. So I looked at this one here, this Google one that they're building in the Netherlands, and 120 megawatt data center, right? And I'm like, did a little bit of reading around that. That's quite a lot of electricity, okay? But then it made me think, you guys seen the Back to the Future films?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you remember the DeLorean? 1.21 gigawatts. Kind of puts it in perspective, right? 120 megawatts, Google, yeah, awesome. No. Let's look at the DeLorean, 1.21 gigawatts. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so the SuperNEPs are also about 100 megawatt each.
So what is it, Hans, you might know, what is it about the Netherlands? Because the Netherlands seems to be a bit of an internet hub and a bit of a data center hub in Europe.
Yeah, so the Netherlands is one of those places in Europe where the lines from across the ocean come.
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons. And there's also something tax-wise. They call the Dutch money, right, sandwich, yeah. I think is the name. You should look that up. So there's always money involved. So taxes is one, but it's also a big internet hub because of the internet lines that arrive in Amsterdam somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, but I get the feeling that in a European perspective, it may even be bigger than London from a data center and an internet perspective. But I do know that. So I knew a guy who lived in Canary Wharf in London, which is, you know, there's a bunch of data centers around that area, and he's saying, yeah, they've got these awesome data centers and stuff, but they have one of the crappest internet connect, you know, for for like a home user, just about the worst internet connection you can get in the whole of the UK. So it doesn't necessarily pay to live next door to an awesome data center. You're still on like a 56K modem line practically. Let's talk about NetApp for a minute though, because NetApp I don't know what they've done actually. I don't want to give them a hard time here because we were talking about this before we started recording the podcast. You know, we have a go at the vendors when they do these all singing, all dancing announcements where they pack people into minis and they do all kinds of crazy stunts and stuff. And we say, oh, another overhyped, overmarketed vendor product announcement. But then I was having a bit of a moan about NetApp on Twitter earlier today because they've kind of sneaked a new product out there in their FlashRay product. Any thoughts on that?
It's not the Mega Launch, at least. It's announced, so the news is not that big. The only news of this week is that it's shipping. That's the news. It's been announced a year ago. Somehow behind the curtains, they announced that they're going to build a new all-flash product from scratch with a new operating system. So not ONTAP based. I think it's called Mars OS. Yep. So totally new operating system. And the only news of this week is that it's shipping.
I've got to throw a question though, Hans. I appreciate that they announced it early 2013, I think. But they must have been working on it for a lot longer than that, right? I mean, you don't bring anything close to a GA product on a new platform, software platform here, the Mars OS, in anything like 12 to 24 months, right?
No,
not indeed. I mean, they're claiming they filed over 200 patents just on the Mars OS itself. You know, and I think the workloads will be interesting to see what they go after. I think this will probably, I mean, if you listen to what they're talking about, it's going to be, hey, we're going to go after that database market hot and heavy. So you'll see some real optimization around those types of workloads. I mean, if you think about it, compare, you know, the mature storage vendors versus the startups. And, you know, it's the David Goliath discussion. But, you know, in reality, those mature storage players have, you know, large swaths of history with all the different workloads that are out there that the younger companies don't. And so they, you know, they have a little bit of deeper insight into some of these things. And that's where they really get their penetration. You know, that's where Extreme.io gets a large, you know, jump on the market when they go to Marketplace, Hitachi, others. They all have this, you know, pedigree of performance and experience that they can, you know, rely back upon. So, you know, it is interesting to see a you know, quote unquote, a 1.0 product release with a soft launch. And, you know, I think it's kind of testing the waters and to see what it looks like and to see what kind of, you know, customers are going to come to it. And, you know, it gives you time to kind of focus on your message because, you know, Flash is still kind of a nascent industry for the most part. I think a lot of organizations are still trying to understand what they want to do with Flash inside their organization and if it even makes sense.
So would you say then that this soft launch is just something to touch base and see what happens rather than the big push that EMC did with Extreme.io telling everyone this is their GA product that's going to solve the world's problems?
Well, what you do is you under promise and over deliver instead of over promise and under deliver. And so that's maybe, you know, maybe they saw some of the challenges some of the other products had faced and said, you know what, it's not worth it for us to go out there guns a-blazing just yet until we know for sure that, you know, this is what it does what we say it does.
Yeah, but who's the type of customer that buys that type of product that is merely a Gen 1?
You'd be surprised. I mean, there are a lot of organizations that are, hey, we're a NetApp shop. We've bought the messaging. You know, they're trusted partners. We bought NetApp in 1994, and we've had it ever since. And then you could say the same thing about EMC and Cisco and HP and Dell and all the others, right? You're always going to have a cadre of customers that is, you know, who they are. And, you know, the account managers and the sales team identify and target those people, and they're the ones that they trust for their input.
Mm-hmm. I think absolutely the likes of EMC and NetApp with some of their key accounts and probably a lot of their accounts, I mean, that their sales guys are almost second to none in being able to control an account, and they want everything, and there's so many EMC and NetApp customers out there that will put their stake in the ground and say, we're an EMC shop or we're a NetApp shop, and are totally happy with it. And know very little about what else is on the market. A little bit probably like with Cisco in the networking market, maybe less so now, but always in the past. You know, there were so many customers out there just wouldn't look at anything Cisco.
You cannot sell me that someone buying today an all-flash array doesn't know that there's more than NetApp in the market.
Now, they know that there's more in the market, but they're so bedded in with the likes of EMC and NetApp, and not just at the technology guys level, but also at senior management and C-level execs, that it's just the comfortable, easy choice to go with another product from those guys.
That's a top-down sale, and it always is, especially at certain levels of specific relationships. There are people that, you know, it's like, hey, I can call the CFO of Coors and say, hey, I got this product, I want you to try it, and he's going to bring it in and make the company use it.
Yeah, and the technology guys have no choice in the matter.
I've worked in several organizations where, hey, this wasn't the right product for us, but it's the one that was foisted on us, right? Make it work. That was your job. And if you didn't do it, then, you know, we'll find somebody who does. And that's kind of a harsh reality. But there is a lot of selling that happens inside the enterprise space where it is, you know, it's a relationship. It's not the technology. And I've preached endlessly that the best technology always doesn't win. It's, you know, a lot of it for a lot of these large organizations is the relationships that they've built up and the trust that they've built up over the years.
And a great sales team quite often as well. I know that in the Extreme.io discussions that I've had in the last couple of weeks, people have been saying things like, you know, Extreme.io is the fastest selling or, you know, the highest grossing product, whatever they say. And they always say, because it's the best technology. And I'm not knocking it as a technology. I'm sure it's great. In fact, one of my old bosses who I trust a lot is a real big fan of it. So I'm not knocking it as a technology. But the fact is that the success of Extreme.io and, you know, a bunch of other products from other vendors as well is down to the sales guys, the way that it's marketed and the way that it's sold. It's a success of marketing and sales. So often, and very, very rarely does it come down to the best technology, sadly.
Not the best, but in the long term, it needs to be a good product, at least.
And they usually do end up being good products, right? I mean, nobody's going to buy a crappy product year after year.
Yeah.
No, that's why the Yugo doesn't exist.
Yeah. Now, what do we know about this FlashRay then? Because it was kind of a soft launch, and they haven't said a great deal. So what is there out there in the public domain that we know?
I mean, from what I can tell, I mean, other than a couple blog posts, you know, there was an article in the Register. There was, you know, Nate Adamson, who runs Tech Ops Guys, wrote a really, you know, he's a very pro HP, but he's definitely got a good ear for the storage industry and has been writing about storage for a number of years. I know him and I value his.
Oh, he's a great guy. Yeah,
and you know, so it's people like that that really have a vested interest. They want to tear apart every storage platform that comes on the market and compare it to, you know, their use case and maybe other potential use cases. So you can always go, you know, Google around, but you know, really, it's all that we heard that it was a single controller system. And then once that came out, the Register article, people started to lose themselves. And, you know, And the reality is, I don't know why that would be the decision to go to market with that. There are a lot of storage products out there that do that way, and there's other ways to mitigate, you know, high availability. So, you know, we should get somebody from NetApp on.
Yeah. I'm okay with a single controller system if it's scale out.
Right.
If it's share nothing, but I haven't seen that yet, so.
No, I've not heard any word of that. So what I've got down so far is, yeah, single controller at the moment, of course, fiber channel only. And then I'm inferring just from the wider NetApp portfolio, right? Let's give them some credit here. They've got an all-flash FAS and they've got an all-flash E-series. So, you know, we're not saying they don't have an all-flash platform that they can push to anybody. They do. Maybe they're not the greatest for every workload, okay?
We had the same thing at EMC right before the Extreme IO launch. They had the VNXE all-flash.
Absolutely, and
Which they said it will both serve a specific market.
Yeah. So very similar to that with EMC, because of their existing portfolio, I'm going to infer that this is really going for that very top performance category, that ultra-low latency, because they've kind of already got product that fits the pretty decent performance, pretty low latency. This has got to be like a violin or an extreme killer, and not that it's going to kill them, but in that kind of segment, yeah?
You know, it depends. I mean, right now the system's going to ship with less than 10 terabytes of usable storage. So there's a specific case for that, whether it be OLTP workloads, which I think that would probably be the bulk of it. You know, we'll see. I really think that, you know, market forces being what they are, sometimes you have to release a product ahead of schedule or ahead of what you would normally want to go to market with, just so you can stay relevant and not look like you're not doing anything, right? And we all know that there are a ton of storage companies out there today, the hybrids especially, the Nimbles, the Tegiles, et cetera, that, you know, have been basically feasting on market share from large companies like NetApp. You know, you don't IPO without somebody's business to take from them, right? And that's what we've seen over the last couple. I mean, Equalogic did the same thing, you know, and now people are starting to eat up Equalogic share, right? You know, dated controller technology. I mean, ONTAP, I mean, and I'm not the biggest NetApp guy. I just don't, you know, I've never really used it. It's never been my forte. But, you know, I think we've kind of reached some of the limits with some of that technology. Otherwise, if that was not the case, why would they need to build a new OS just to address flash?
Right? Absolutely.
Right? Shouldn't you be able to shoehorn it into NetApp? They tried it with PAM cards for the cache accelerator. You know, obviously they have a go-to-market strategy with this. It was a soft launch. It was a product that, you know, didn't meet a lot of what we would consider the traditional enterprise check marks. We'll see how that pans out for them. It's a calculated risk, you know?
Absolutely. And one of the promises that I did get from some of this, the reading that I did around it, was interoperability or compatibility, or I forget what the phrase they used was, but was with ONTAP. And I thought to myself, well, what are they talking about here? Because, you know what, there was still so little information. And I figured, I'm sure they're not going to be saying, well, it can replicate to ONTAP or it can scale with ONTAP.
No, no, it's probably going to be about moving data from one to
absolutely
another. And,
right.
And tooling, just management from the same platform. That's probably going to be where they want to go.
So if it's about moving data or migrating data, and this is total speculation here, does that say something about the life expectancy of ONTAP?
No.
No, not necessarily.
It's got such a huge install base that, you know, it would probably take a good 10 years to migrate all of it that's in their existence today off to other things. I still think that they're going to continue to develop ONTAP and that platform continue to evolve. You know, if you talk to somebody like Demetrius or any of the big NetApp guys, you know, they'll have a really unique perspective on it that maybe the corporate NetApp hasn't exposed to the rest of us.
Yeah, I mean, it's a smart move.
There, yeah.
It's a smart move to design a new operating system specifically developed for Flash. I mean, it's
true.
The best move to do. It's not necessary to move everything that is in the market today to that new operating system. It's ONTAP is probably not a bad operating system today, even though it's old, but there's been working on for years and years in development on it. So I'm not sure that ONTAP is that dead that they need to move everything off it to a new operating system that is specifically designed for Flash only.
And let's not forget, they have only just recently, in the grand scheme of things, I guess, finished off their clustered data on tap version. Yeah. So to say, oh, well, we've just finished that huge piece of work that was like years and years in the making. Yeah, let's forget that. And we're going to go with Miles OS now. Not going to happen, right?
No. The operating systems that were written for traditional standard disk just do not apply when it comes to Flash, right? And I think that that's what we're starting to realize, that, you know, the way you address Flash, the way Flash reads and writes to get the best performance out of it, you do a lot, you do things a lot differently than you would with traditional spinning media.
Well, on that then, right before we started recording the show, I was having a bit of an exchange on Twitter with my old HP sales guy from my previous job, who's a obviously, right, HP sales guy, but he's a massive fan of the 3PAR7450, which is their all-flash array. But it runs the same code that the 7400 uses, the 7200, all the old T-classes, things like that. And he's really trying to say that, you know what, we've got an architecture and a code base here that can do spinning disk and all-flash. And you know what, I'll give them credit here, HP. They ponied up to SPC1 with the 3PAR array, and they've gone to market with and shown the market what the performance results are, which we can't say for a lot of the other guys. Now, my take on it is it's going to be difficult for them, right, to optimize the 3PAR operating system for spinning media and for flash and whatever solid state comes in the future as well. But right now, they seem to have a fairly decent story there.
Well, that's because the architecture of the 3PAR was already so modern according to all the other architectures operating systems.
But it's still more than 10 years old, right?
They had the smallest chunklets. They had all that striping to every single disk from every single controller. They had the big mesh. They have the ASIC to do extra calculations. I mean, it was a pretty modern modern architecture from the beginning, and that's why they can keep up today. I don't know if they're gonna keep up in 3 or 5 years, but today I think that the 3PAR all flash is a really good beast in the market.
So I'm just googling 3PAR here because I want to find out how old it is as a company. I'm sure it's way more than 10 years old.
I think probably close, shipping first 2003.
But a lot of the magic, you know, a lot of the secret sauce in 3PAR is their ASIC. And when you design for an ASIC, you're designing for a time horizon that's, you know, 2 to 3 years of useful life for a lot of that stuff, because it takes a long time to spin up a chip and it takes a lot of money to do it. And with that in mind, maybe they started developing for the flash portion of it 2 to 3 years ago when they started to see the market move that place and the new generation of chips have the capability to leverage that performance properly.
That would be some awesome foresight. I don't know that I give them that much credit.
No, I've
that's
had
how they
the,
got dedupe the conversation. The system as well.
Yeah,
I've had the conversation with the team when they brought the new system on with the all-flash, and indeed they have changed parts of the ASIC very specific for flash, and it's been more than a year and a half now since that on at HP Discover when they showed me all those details, and they actually did they changed parts of even how small it already was, the chunks. So but they I don't know, there were things that they didn't check for the writes on the other side, and just if it's still in memory and so on. They changed a lot in the ASIC, and the ASIC is now on its fourth or fifth generation, and every single time when they bring a next generation of the ASIC on, they still question, well, can we do it already in Intel or not?
Yeah.
Can we leave it? So they're not married to the ASIC for the long term. They every single time that a new generation of the ASIC comes out, they question it. Well, is it still necessary or not? And apparently it does.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think HP are bucking the trend here by not having a new architecture for an all-flash array, but they're also bucking the trend in being very ASIC-centric. And I think in the long run, it's going to be hard to buck both of those trends. It seems to be working for them now. Interested to see how it goes for them, but I think that's a piece of work that is bucking both of those trends. And if it doesn't work, then they are a long way behind on an all-flash product.
Well, if you look at the top five I'm looking on the SPC site right now, the top five of performance, I mean, just raw performance, Caminario, Huawei, IBM, HDS.
Yeah.
Right. And then HP comes in at 6, but that's with the 9500.
Oh, so, right. Okay.
And that's an all SSD version. And some of these results are still a little bit dated. So, you know, it's an interesting metric to measure against. And I think those of us who are really geek on storage really like it. But I'm not sure how much weight it carries necessarily with the general storage buying populace.
I don't think it really does hardly any at all. And I know that they don't lead with anything like that in sales, but I do think it's credit to them for ponying up and actually submitting a raise to the SPC benchmark.
I mean, there's other organizations that will just never, they'll never put something out there unless it's, you know, the lab queen, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Which I don't like.
No. Always the devil's in the details. It's not the executive report. It's the deeper one that really goes into the what that looked like and how many engines were used and how many file systems and everything else to really get those results. It's, you know,
you remember that
two, it was the VNX one that was a little bit interesting.
What was it? Yeah. VNX.
It had eight engines or something like, or maybe it was
VNX. And like 750, so many flash drives,
flash disks for 500k IOPS.
Yeah. Insane.
But that denotes that IOPS is the only thing we should be measuring. And I think that that's where we start to make...
No, latency as well.
That's a fool's errand, right? But there's a lot more to it.
And you know what? I'm convinced that VNX that EMC submitted, they did that to make a mockery of the benchmark.
It was.
Not to say this is what the array can do. They did that to say, look at how pointless this benchmark is. Which, if they did, I think was fairly clever of them.
Well, it obviously was. I mean, they were coming with an 8-rack system. and I remember that the week before, just a few weeks before that, Nigel, we were in Vienna and we saw 1 million IOPS coming out of a single server. Remember that?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
1 million IOPS.
That was the first time we were blown away by Fusion IO. They just put 10 cards in a single server and just ran by accident 1 million IOPS. It was like, okay, so this is one server versus 8 racks with 400 or 700 flash disks. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, can I switch gears a little bit then? So I was reading OpenStack related here that Canonical, so the guys that are in charge of Ubuntu Linux and Oracle, are kind of joining forces with their OpenStack platforms and they're going to be compatible with each other and what have you. Seems to be that they're gunning for, or they've got Red Hat in the crosshairs there. And I'm thinking this is all kind of interesting and what have you, but I just can't get my head around whether or not in the long run, OpenStack is going to be anything even close to a formidable competitor to the AWS, the Google, the Azure. I know it seems like it's got HP behind it, it's got Cisco behind it, it's got IBM behind it, it's got Red Hat behind it. But these are all kind of the traditional enterprise IT companies. And is it going to ever get enough traction to be a valid competitor to the Goliaths in this space, to the AWS, the Google, the Azures?
What's the alternative?
But
do we need one?
I think if you want to do on-premises cloud, private cloud, then that's your alternative, or that's your option, is to use OpenStack or some flavor or variant of it. If you want to put everything into the private cloud or public cloud, then AWS, Google, some of those. And if you want a hybrid model, you have to have something that can bridge the gap between the two.
But this is technology talk. This is technology talk. The whole thing that is happening with OpenStack is partnership talk, is what's next. Everyone now works around VMware, and we know that story has had its peak now. I mean, it's not going away, but what's...
Peak VMware.
Yeah. What's next? Everyone's looking at what's next. What's next is not all the enterprise vendors are going to give everything away to an Amazon, and especially not to an Oracle or so. So that's the what's next question. OpenStack today is that surge to what's next in the industry.
I would agree too, and I think that, you know, there is, as we start, I mean, is if you look, go back 5-6 years, what was the state of automation and private cloud computing back then? Man, it was a disaster, right? And, you know, I think what OpenStack did was to basically take the science experiment that came out of NASA and put it into a state where you had a community that was passionate about this particular model of doing business within the enterprise. And now you have a group of contributors and people who, you know, really see this as the future for a lot of private cloud implementations. And therefore, you know, they've invested a lot of time and effort in it. And then obviously the big enterprise companies or the big, you know, vendors see this as kind of the writing on the wall. And now they want to make sure that they don't get left behind, or at least they're part of that discussion.
But by the time OpenStack gets to a point where, you know, most enterprise organizations are comfortable with it, they've got skills, they can start building their own kind of on-premise clouds, are we not at that point then going to be, I don't know, a million times more comfortable with public cloud and just be putting, by then, the vast majority of our workloads out to the more scalable public cloud? And then suddenly what we thought that OpenStack was going to address in the enterprise and, you know, the on-premise side of things is like a really small part of our infrastructure.
I think the problem with timing is, when is there going to be a leader instead of old boys club building new stuff? That's what's happening now. Everyone is partnering together, and it's just one big happy family, and we're all going to commit to OpenStack. But we need a new strong leader taking the leadership role. We need a new VMware that's in OpenStack.
They need their version of Linus.
And from everything is written in the stars for that to be Red Hat, but I'm not sure that Red Hat has the ability to become the new VMware.
They'd love to, but that's a big ask. I saw recently as well, I think sometime in August, Linux as an operating system turned 23. I'm like, 23? You know, since Linus Torvalds did his original, hi, everybody out there using Minix, go give Linux a try, yeah? 23 years is a long time. In comparison, OpenStack is, I don't know, what is that? 4 years, maybe a little bit less, a little bit more than 4 years old? That's not a lot of time to be considered stable for the enterprise. Not just as a product, right, but as a new way of doing things. It's such a massive change, and it's still so young.
But there's more commitment. That's a big difference.
Yeah. Everybody's jumped in. I mean, everybody.
A billion dollars each, right?
So it's the rate of adoption in that true enterprise space. You know, there are very few things that you see take off as quickly as this has, right? If you went to OpenStack Summit, you know, you saw the discussions, and it was from, you know, the leaders in that space that are at the top of the pyramid. It was all the telcos. It was AT&T. It was eBay. It was those types of organizations. And I think today that's where you're seeing the most implementation or adoption of OpenStack. And if I look at, like, if I draw a pyramid of it, you're going to see that top 10% of organizations that have, you know, data scientists on staff and the kind of technical talent that they can deliver in OpenStack and actually understand and benefit from the economics of it. Then you have between 10% and 50% that is going to be the battle between the Red Hat and VMware and Hyper-V, the people that still want to do it on premises. And then you're going to have everybody else at the bottom that sends it all to the cloud. That's just how I kind of see it shaking out over the course of the next, you know, the short term, the 3 year term, right? And, you know, we'll see what happens to OpenStack as a platform. You know, I don't know if everybody can keep up to a 6 month release cycle and if that's really the benefit to the benefit of everybody that's out there, right? Because by the time you've got, you know, one version up and running and baked in and you're happy with it, the next one has already come out and now you're going to start always playing catch up. I think the release cycle needs to lengthen a little bit.
Yeah, that totally doesn't work with traditional enterprises.
Right. And to give people time to really adopt, right?
I'd agree.
Mm-hmm.
So, guys, I think we talked about a lot of technologies there tonight. I know that we are the In Tech We Trust podcast, but this week I went with a bit of In Facebook We Trust. Now, actually, in saying that, I should say I'm not suggesting you do trust Facebook. I don't personally have any major issues with them, but I know a lot of people have trust issues with Facebook and what have you. But I saw that Mr. Farley had a birthday over the weekend. Did you guys know that?
Oh,
I did.
Hey now.
So a big hey now to Mark, and I've got this little message for you.
Happy birthday to you.
Now, that would have been a million times better if, Gabriel, that was you on the piano and that was you singing, Hans, but I don't know that we've got the skills for that.
I think my voice is a little bit lower.
I thought that was your voice, actually. I bet that's what you sound like when you sing.
Reminds me of the Saturday Night Live skit, Season's Greetings from Tonto, Tarzan, and one other, like the Lone Ranger or something.
Oh, I don't know that. I'll have to look that up.
It's a good one.
Yeah. Cool. So, anything else to say, gents, before we close out the show with another secret Windows phone app?
Nah. Looking forward to 5 days in the Austrian mountains and Oktoberfest in Germany.
Nice. I will Oracle Open World next week and then prepping to go to VMworld Barcelona.
So Oracle Open World is massive, right? I've never been, but that's like by
20,000 miles.
No. Oracle World is the biggest one.
Yeah, you're right. I saw somebody put a chart out. I'd have to go find it.
So Oracle World, humongous. To give it perspective, VMworld was 23,000 people. Oracle World is 40.
Oh, there you go. Dear me.
Those islands won't pay for themselves.
No, I guess they won't. So I think that's it then. Let's wrap this show up with another secret Windows phone app from Mark Farley.
Hello, this is Mark Farley, and you're listening to Secret Windows Phone Apps. And today, we're going to be talking about something that's very, very secret.
I love you.
Like how to hide your Windows phone when you don't want someone to know that you have one. There can be a lot of reasons for keeping your Windows phone incognito. Like when you're just about anywhere and somebody else is talking about how cool their phone is and they're showing off all the new features and apps, especially the apps. Now, some people, like Apple fanboys, might think that the Windows App Store is a few clowns short of a circus. But I bet none of them have the app that we're talking about here today. The HoloBook. When your Windows phone is safely inside a HoloBook, nobody can see it or hear it or feel it vibrate. All you need is a HoloBook, which you can make yourself or you can buy at Amazon.com. by searching for HoloBook. There's also a site called freehollowbooks.com, but you have to pay for the books. What's with that? And you can see how to make one with a video and everything on WikiHow if you search for Make a HoloBook. I recommend getting a copy of Building Storage Networks and hollowing it out.
Why?
And even if you don't have a Windows phone, but you still hollow out Building Storage Networks, please send me the pictures, because I want to see what you're hiding in it.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're a self-published author with a Windows phone, nobody wants to read your book.
Oh.
And so it's a super secret place for your phone. It's bad enough that the Windows phone already hinders your ability to participate in social networks. But it's my sincerest wish that the secret HoloBook app will keep your Windows phone from being a further social liability to you. Tune in again to hear another episode of Secret Windows Phone Apps.